if you like the Scandinavian model, then that is not the tax system that they use.
Right.
In Scandinavia, they are taxing the middle class, and it is not a Robin Hood society where they're taking from the rich and giving to everyone else. It doesn't work that way.
Socialism podcast, where we've been trying to understand more about what socialism is, what it is not, and what life is like under actual socialist societies. In this episode, I'm joined once again by Dr. Stephen Gloperman. Steve is a senior fellow in the Addington Chair in Measurement at the Fraser Institute. He's the author of over 200 articles and monographs, and he has served a very pivotal role in the conception of and the execution of this Major Realities of Socialism podcast and book series. He's edited many of the publications in this series, and today we're going to talk about kind of the overarching lessons that we might be able to draw from the work that's been done and highlight some of the conversations that we've had in this podcast series with other guests. So Steve, thank you so much for having this conversation with me today.
You're welcome.
So I want to start this episode off with a bit of a different question than I normally start with. I'd love to learn more about what the inspiration and motivation behind this project was.
So the motivation was a perception on the part of my colleagues at the Fraser and myself, and by the way, a belief that was backed up by a number of surveys that there was growing support in developed countries for socialism. The support was particularly strong amongst younger people, that is, people in their 20s and early 30s. And we thought this was an interesting phenomenon because the obvious track record of socialism, where it's been tried, where it's been manifested in its traditional form, was a disaster, a social and economic disaster. And so we were interested in learning more about, well, first confirming our priors that there really is this underlying growing support for socialism. And secondly, what do people think about when they support socialism? And then a relook, really, and an extension of our scholarship that's been done on the effects of socialism, and what can we tell young people who seem to believe that socialism is a preferred system? What should you really know about socialism? And that's the realities of socialism that we were interested in.
And throughout the series, we've covered a variety of topics, from kind of what the definition of socialism is and the various meanings that it has to the general public. And we've looked at some in-depth case studies of traditional socialist societies like Estonia and Poland. Based on the data, what younger folks are thinking about as socialists are really places like Sweden and Denmark, and to an extent, Singapore. So learning a lot about what their economic systems actually look like is really, really enlightening. So I want to kind of recap some of these conversations and some of these finding. So some of the first conversations we had were with Jim Otteson and Jason Clements, focusing on, as you said, that polling data and talking a little bit about the theoretical and philosophical arguments that were for and against socialism. So can we just kind of talk about how, what the meaning of socialism was traditionally, how public opinion about what socialism is, how that shifted, And kind of some of the key debates that have played a role in, I guess, maybe a modern version of the socialist calculation debate.
Right. Well, to set the context, Jim Otteson, who contributed one of the volumes to our series, thinks about economic systems, I think correctly, as a continuum, and thinking about socialism along this continuum. At the extreme, traditional socialism is a system where the government really controls almost entirely the allocation and distribution of economic resources. In other words, bureaucrats are really running the economic system. There's no price system. There's very little participation in decision-making, in real decision-making by private sector actors. So that's one extreme. And that's really where we started the series with Poland and Estonia when it was part of the USSR. It was a traditional socialist society. Our survey, our own survey, which you've talked about earlier in earlier podcast, was a survey of people of different ages in Canada, the U.S., the U.K., and Australia. And one of the findings of the survey was support for that traditional form of socialism is present to a certain extent, but that isn't really the main way that particularly young people think about socialism or, in fact, support socialism. So along the spectrum, along that continuum, we have countries like Sweden and Denmark, where there is a vibrant private sector, but the government is a very large player in the economy in the form of primarily taxing and using the tax money to provide a variety of services, education, healthcare, but we're talking about more than 50% of the economy, either directly or indirectly, being influenced by government action. And you know, the rubric that people use for the Nordic countries, Sweden and Denmark included, is social democracy, because it is a democracy. But it's a socialist democracy, at least that's how young people think of it, because it provides extensive and virtually universal social services. And that was what received the greatest support in the survey that we did. That's what, in particular, young people favor. They also favor a universal basic income, a guaranteed income, which Sweden and Denmark do not have, but that was part of what people wanted or seemed to like about socialism, of the socialist democracy variety. Singapore is an interesting example of what some people call state capitalism, it's socialist in terms of Jim Otteson's terminology or framework, because the Singaporean government, from the time it became independent in 1965, has played a major role in encouraging investment in particular industries, and they have subsidized the development of these industries. They've also taken ownership in leading companies like the airline, some of the banks. And so government does play a significant role in Singapore's economic system. But that was not what young people thought of when they said, we want socialism. I think it's fair to say that what our survey shows, and it was consistent with earlier surveys by other organizations, is that young people want an active government that's providing all kinds of social services and a guaranteed income. But I just want to say this, Rosa, because this is a key finding. How does this get paid for?
Right.
When we asked in the survey, do you support a broad-based tax system? where the middle class is paying a large share of the taxes that are needed to fund these services. That idea was rejected largely. What people favored in the survey was taxing the wealthy, a wealth tax, a tax on the top 1%. And what it's fair to say is, if you like the Scandinavian model, then that is not the tax system that they use.
Right.
In Scandinavia, they are taxing the middle class. And it is not a Robin Hood society where they're taking from the rich and giving to everyone else. It doesn't work that way.
Right. That was, so out of what you just mentioned, there's two things that I wanted to highlight about that. The first is, I think that the commonly held misconception that what Sweden is doing is redistributing from the wealthy to the poor. My conversation with Johan Norberg was just really illuminating. There was a lot that I didn't know about. And he really emphasized that the Swedish model is you're redistributing from yourself to yourself at various stages in your life. Right. And as economists, we talk a lot about there's no such thing as a free lunch. If you want this large, extensive social safety net, right, and you want the government to facilitate that, I hesitate to use the word provide. They're not, you know, they're facilitating the moving around of these resources. That is expensive and it needs to be paid for somehow. And the Scandinavian model is really about redistributing from yourself to yourself at different stages in your life. And I thought that was a really, that was illuminating to me. And I think that that's something that not a lot of my students and other people in Gen Z, they don't really think of it that way. That's not something they're aware of. The other thing that I found interesting about what you just said that I wanted to talk a little bit about, so I'm really glad you brought it up, is that I tend to be a let me look on the bright side of things kind of person. I jokingly say I'm a pessimist because I get disappointed less often if I have really low expectations. But in reality, I am trying to look on the bright side of things most of the time. And one of the optimistic conclusions I've reached from reading this work and talking to all of these scholars is that the goalposts on the conversation about socialism have really shifted, right? In the 1940s, 50s, 60s, we're talking, I mean, all the way up through the fall of the USSR, really, in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, we were talking about the virtues of a completely centrally planned system, right? Almost nobody is having that conversation. I mean, there are still people having that conversation today, but the majority of the people that support socialism have kind of accepted that that's not the system that we're really looking for. We're really looking for this mostly a market system, but we're going to have significant redistribution and significant social safety net. So I think that maybe is a sign that the arguments of scholars like Hayek and Mises that Odison brings up in those earlier podcasts, that they were effective and kind of the evidence of, you know, the failed state, the failed attempt at that type of socialism have really kind of shifted the conversation.
Well, I think that's fair, the traditional socialism that was written about in the Polish, the volumes on Poland and Estonia, that there are not obvious champions of that in Western countries. Although I have to say, every once in a while, people look at China and say, oh, isn't it nice that the government has control of things and can make things happen fast? You want an airport, it's done in a week because the government's doing it. But no, I agree with that. Although what I'm noticing is that increasingly the Singapore example is having more salience. And what I have in mind here is, as you well know, in both Canada and the United States, there's increasing an increasing initiative to have industrial policies where the government is deciding, well, this is the industry or set of industries that really should grow, so let's throw a lot of money at these. And I'm thinking of green energy, for example, artificial intelligence, semiconductor chips. The amount of government, let me just say government decision-making in Jim Otteson's sense, where the government is saying, look, resources should go to this sector and we're going to make it happen through subsidies and subsidized loans. This is becoming more and more of a phenomenon in Western countries. And here, I think the Singapore experience can be very illuminating, because this was, as I mentioned earlier, a feature of Singapore's economic development, the government actively promoting specific companies and specific industries to grow.
So they're kind of putting their thumb on the scale a little bit and giving, because if you're promoting one industry, then by default you're kind of stacking the odds against other businesses and other industries. And so if you would, can you speak a little bit to the arguments that scholars like Hayek and Mises made about why doing something like that is going to have some unpleasant consequences?
Yeah, and the big feature of the Hayekian model is the issue of information. If government bureaucrats are going to make decisions about where the greatest value added to society is going to come from, is it going to come from green energy? Is it going to come from something else? Where are they getting their information? And why should they be better informed about making these risk-taking decisions whose effects are going to be felt 5, 10, 15 years down the road? Why are they better capable of making that decision than the hundreds of thousands or millions of private sector actors who, to a greater or lesser extent, are going to allocate resources of their own resources, their own savings, their own labor, in a direction that they think is going to add the greatest value to society? I think it's fair to say that, and we can get back to the Singapore example, because we need to discuss why Singapore enjoyed such incredible economic success when bureaucrats and politicians were making some of the decisions about where resources should go. So let's table that for the moment and get back to the issue of why, in general, economists don't think it's a good idea for governments to have these kinds of extensive industrial policies. Well, the information issue is one, but also the issue of responsibility is the other. If a private decision maker is, let's just say, hasn't done their homework as carefully as they should have, or for whatever reason are making bad decisions, the market will discipline them. That is, they're going to lose their money and they'll go out of business, and the resources that they were formerly directing are going to wind up in other hands who are more competent to use them efficiently. Well, if a bureaucrat makes a bad decision, a seriously bad decision, here's $100 billion to this particular industry, and the industry turns out to be surpassed by another technology, how is that bureaucrat disciplined? Well, are they going to be fired? Maybe, but that's really not going to be, they'll get another job. But it's not the same thing as losing all your money. It's both information and incentives that matter, and both of those are they're muted when you have the government playing the role of the decision maker versus the private sector.
So I want to get back to that interesting point that you did table, because if we think about Singapore, Denmark, and Sweden, interesting thing about all three of those countries is if you look at the Fraser Institute's Economic Freedom of the World Index, all three of those countries rank in the top 20 most economically free countries. And in the most recent edition, Singapore was number one, right? Freest economy in the world that we're talking about as an example of kind of state involvement. So how can those two things be true at the same time?
It was an interesting country to study precisely because of that, Rosie. How can you square that circle?
Right.
The primary author in the volume, Brian Chang, he squares the circle in part, and he acknowledges that he doesn't have all the answers, but he tries to square the circle by pointing out that even in the case of what in Singapore are called government-linked corporations, and in other places they're called state-owned enterprises, where the government is a major owner of a company. What Brian argued was that there is still a very, very strong commercial discipline that's present in the management of the companies. That is, the managers of the government-linked corporations in Singapore are expected to operate as they would if they were completely privately owned. And let me just say that in some cases, there is private ownership. It's a shared government-private ownership. So it's a mixed enterprise. But the managers are expected to be profitable. They are expected to have competition. That is, they're not protected. The walls aren't sealed off so that other companies can't compete. There's no special tax breaks that they get. There's no special subsidies. It's really almost a founder's stake that the government is taking. Now, Brian is humble enough to say that, look, he cannot say, well, if the counterfactual were the case, if there were no government ownership, these companies would do even better. I mean, that's a possibility. And he acknowledges the possibility. But the main point he makes is that other than that feature of government owning some shares of these linked corporations, these companies and the Singapore economy as a whole is very open to competition. Business taxes are very low. Companies are rewarded. They can keep a large part of the profits they make to reinvest. Individuals are rewarded for performance. It's a meritocracy where you are rewarded for your performance, and probably the most important point, because this is the feature that makes it's a necessary feature if an economy is going to be successful. It has a price system functioning where the government is not mucking around with a lot of regulations that distort the workings of the price system. And going back to Hayek, what for Hayek is really the most a feature of an economy that allows it to function efficiently is a well-functioning price system.
Cool. Yeah, I always try to impart to my students that the price system is an amazing communicator of information if you let it be, right? If it's not encumbered by burdensome regulation, as you said, or infringements on property rights. So it seems that Singapore has managed to still let that price system operate despite the involvement of government and bureaucrats in that process. There's still price signal. It might be a muted signal. It might be a little bit different than it would be if there were no state involvement, but they still have meaningful information to help guide the decisions.
That's correct. But we don't want to lose sight of the fact that there's also the incentive issue, that people have incentives to operate their assets efficiently because they're keeping a large part of the rewards of what they make from their intelligent decisions and risk taking.
Another kind of really important aspect I think that you mentioned is that even though that they're kind of state state-sponsored or state-operated enterprises, they're not a monopoly over what they're doing, right? There is competition. And I think the public choice literature, I think about Gordon Tullock offering advice about how to improve bureaucratic efficiency, introduce, you know, he would emphasize you privatize the entity, but privatization without competition is going to give us bad incentives too, right? And so the competition aspect of it is really, really important.
Absolutely. And that's a feature of Singapore that should be emphasized. It is open to trade. And in a small economy, and I would include Canada and Sweden and Denmark in that category, they're small open economies. What brings a lot of competition into the economy is foreign trade. It's imports, it's foreign investment. And those economies are open to trade and investment. And that's a very important feature.
So I do want to kind of draw some comparisons between Sweden, Denmark, and Singapore. So I already mentioned one of the things that I see being common through all three of those countries is that they are largely committed to economic freedom, competition. Would it be right to kind of conclude from that if you want to have these extensive social safety nets facilitated by the government, that a market-oriented economy, you're not going to be able to afford to do this in the absence of a market economy?
Yes, I think that's absolutely fair to say. And the Sweden and Denmark examples highlight this. These are countries where, as we were talking about earlier, the average tax rate and the highest marginal tax rate, and I'm talking about the income tax rate, is quite high. And there's a 25% of value added, or basically sales tax. But corporate income taxes and gains taxes are relatively low. And in Singapore, they're 15%. The highest marginal income tax rate is 15%. The tax structures encourage risk-taking and investment, which encourage economic growth. And you're right. Without economic growth, these social safety nets are unaffordable. And both Sweden and Denmark realized this in the 1970s and early 1980s, where they kept pushing government spending up and into very difficult economic problems with inflation and a collapsing currency, and had to back off. They had the share of the economy that the government accounted for in its spending was reduced from close to 60% to closer to 48-49%, because it was clear to Swedes, and same experience in Denmark, this was unsustainable. There is a limit, because the more government pushes its way into the economy, the more you're jeopardizing the growth of the economy. And they hit the wall in the late 1970s, early 1980s.
Now, if I recall correctly, one of the things that stood out to me about Denmark is they don't have many instances of the government running budget deficit.
No, that's true. And that was part of the lesson that was learned in the 1970s. It is that a small open economy like Sweden, like Denmark, and I might say like Canada, relies to a significant extent on foreign savings. If you're going to borrow money, there's a limit to how much you can borrow domestically when you're a small economy. And if you're not running a fiscal ship that looks like it's going to sail and not sink, you're not going to attract foreign money. And that's part of the reason that the Swedish and Danish currencies were collapsing in value in the late 1970s, early in the 1980s, because foreign investors lost confidence that they would be paid back for the money that they were lending to the Swedish government and the Danish government, given the fiscal policies that were in place at the time. So the lesson that was learned by both those countries was, we need to keep our fiscal house in order and put in place legislation and practices which ensured that deficits, I'm talking about public deficits, government deficits, would remain constrained. That is, there were fiscal rules that limited how much debt those governments could accumulate because of the experience of the 1970s.
Well, so if I were a young person, you know, who is kind of thinks that Denmark, Sweden, and Singapore, that sounds like a pretty nice deal, right? What they're offering sounds pretty good. Is it the case that we could, in other countries, easily or reasonably emulate what these approaches look like? I think about, you know, I live in the United States, and the last time we had a budget surplus was the 1990s. I was pretty young. The last time there was a budget surplus in the government spending. So, you know, what are some of the things that would stand in the way of other societies trying to mimic or emulate? Because I think it might be a dangerous lesson to take away that we could just easily export what they're doing or import it into our own countries and try to replicate it. What are some of the things that we might have to be cautious of?
Yeah, I that's a fair statement. Let me start with Singapore, because that would probably be the greatest reach for countries like Canada or the United States to say, oh, well, I like the way Singapore grew its economy. Let's do what they do. First of all, I think one has to acknowledge that the political system in Singapore would meet some resistance in countries like Canada and the United States. To be totally blunt, Singapore was and still is what many would call an authoritarian political system. It's a democracy, it's a parliamentary democracy in the sense that it's an elected government. I mean, there are free elections, all right. But there are real constraints on, let's just call them personal liberties. I mean, the classic case that everyone talks about is you can't throw gum on the sidewalk in Singapore and not get arrested. Okay, well, let's acknowledge that, but then let's move on. I think that the real challenge to adopting the Singaporean system for countries like Canada and the United States is accepting the notion of meritocracy and individual responsibility. You really are in Singapore expected to take care of yourself. Now, it's not as though there's no social safety net in Singapore. I mean, there is a government-funded healthcare system which takes care of very low-income people. But it's by and large a distinctive social feature of Singapore is you are expected to take care of yourself, and this manifests in things like if you expect to get unemployment insurance, you have to be looking for a job, and in fact, if you're looking for child support, you're not going to get it unless you're a working parent and then can qualify for it. Well,
and there's the forced savings, right? The forced contributions to retirement. You are expected and mandated to prepare for your old age.
Exactly. That you are expected to save your own income to pay for retirement, for even for health care, for education. Yeah, I just as a broad stroke, my perception is that societies like Canada and the United States are increasingly moving away from individual a social ethic based on individual responsibility to the government should take care of people. And if that's the case, then the Singapore model is probably not going to be a popular one for young people in those in Canada, United States, UK, etc., to look to as a guiding principle. But okay, so what? Even having said that, what can we learn from Singapore that at least is valuable under most circumstances? Well, again, going back to the notion that if you don't have a functioning price system where you have information reliably created by prices and where you have incentives to perform, that is, people are rewarded for the good things that they do economically, you're not going to have success in your economy. Sweden and Denmark, what can we learn from them and what can we import? From them. Well, I think the main thing to learn is if you want a very extensive social network, services network, government pays for healthcare, government pays for education, you've got to be prepared to pay the taxes that's going to support that system. Can that be imported? Is that an idea that would work? Well, our survey says there'd be a lot of resistance to it on the part of young people, but I suppose that's the choice that they would be faced with. You want this model? Well, okay, you have to buy the whole package, and here's what the whole package looks like. But it's also important, again, to emphasize that what those countries have in place is, again, a well-functioning price system, a fairly streamlined regulatory system, so the price system isn't encumbered, as you said, by regulation and by other distortions, and competition. And in particular, Canada can learn from the Sweden and Denmark experience because Canada has extensive protections against imports in a variety of industries and a very extensive set of protections against foreign companies coming into Canada to compete against Canadian companies in industries like telecommunications, and broadcasting and airlines, transportation more generally. That's something that we can learn from Sweden and Denmark, who are, as you mentioned earlier, considered to be freer economies than the Canadian economy or the UK economy or the Australian economy.
I think the US can learn some of those same lessons as well. We have moved increasingly towards trade protections over the past couple of election cycles. So, the one of the things that I was thinking might be a barrier is just kind of the nature of the democratic political process itself. So, the US and Canada, we already have a system that provides certain benefits to certain groups of people. And so if it were to be the case that we wanted to move more towards a Swedish or Danish model, some people would lose the privileges they currently enjoy. It seems like that would be met with some resistance, right, from a public choice standpoint. So one of the barriers that I see is that people would push for it as a, in addition to what we already do, let's also do this instead of kind of restructuring the current system altogether. And that would be completely unsustainable, in my view.
Yeah, and what is interesting about the Swedish and Danish system, and by the way, I would also say the Singaporean system, is that there is a fair amount of social cohesion around what the goals of society are. By the way, this as you know, in the United States, a large economy and a large political structure where there's an awful lot of conflict about basic issues such as what kind of society do we want to be? What do we really value in society? Historically, societies like Sweden and Denmark, and we can talk a little bit about why that is the case, but historically, there's been much more consensus around the issue of what kind of society do we want to be? What do we value as a society? And frankly, in Singapore as well, the ideology of individualism, and you should not be a free rider taking advantage of other people. That's been a strong part of the ideology of that nation state. Can we have that in large countries like the United States? I don't have the answer to that, Rosie.
We have that in states that are incredibly culturally diverse, like the US and Canada? Sweden and Denmark are sort of homogenous populations culturally, at least historically they've been. So I know this episode is going to be a little bit longer than the others because we have so much to kind of cover and recap. And I don't want to neglect the earlier conversations about traditional socialism that happened in Poland and Estonia. So what are some of the lessons that you think we can take from those experiences? To me, Betke talking about Estonia's experience is such a hopeful story about how a country can go so far in one direction towards socialism and see the turmoil and kind of the basic human suffering that it causes, and then still be able within a matter of a generation or two to switch trajectories and to become one of the more economically free countries in the world. Estonia is really a success story. So I would love to hear your thoughts a little bit about Poland and Estonia.
Yeah, well, I mean, the most obvious takeaway from the experience of those two countries under traditional socialism is the extreme misery. Absolutely, beyond economic misery, emotional misery. the most obvious takeaway is you don't want to go there. But if you do, by any reason, find yourself in that kind of extreme, dire immiseration, you can turn it around. But what the Estonia and to a lesser extent, and we can talk a little bit about why it was a lesser extent Poland, what you need to recognize is, yes, you can turn it around, but it's not going to be a smooth glide path. You have to put in place very fundamental changes. Again, back to our point about the price system, you have to allow a functioning price system to take place. You need to make all kinds of reforms to your monetary system, to your fiscal system. You have to get a sound currency. You have to open up your economy to trade and investment. All the things we were talking about earlier that make for a successful economy, those things can be done and were done in Estonia and Poland. And I think one of the points to make about the Estonia case is the reforms were put in place quite quickly. Economists have had a long debate about how quickly to transition those Eastern European countries from traditional socialism to something resembling a capitalist system. Some economists favored a slow glide path and others do it as a shock therapy right away. Estonia
ripped that Band-Aid off.
Correct. Estonia did a quick reform process. And I think what we learned from their experience compared to Poland is probably if any country finds itself in that same situation and wants to move away from it, fast reforms work better than slow reforms, partly for the reason you were mentioning earlier, Rosie, is that the slower you go, the more opportunity you're giving for people, vested interests, to prevent the change from happening. So you want to do it quickly. That's probably the main takeaway from those two countries. Although the one other thing I think is really important to point out, if there was any defense of traditional socialism that was a priori possibly credible, is that at least everyone was okay. You know, everyone had enough to eat. Everyone got an education. Everyone had health care. Everyone had a place to live. And even today, you have people defending systems which are still pretty similar to traditional socialism, such as Cuba. And you often hear people say, well, okay, yeah, there's no political freedom in Cuba, but at least people always have something to eat, and they always have a place to live, and they have health care. Well, the fact of the matter is that Poland and Estonia under traditional socialism were extremely unequal societies, more unequal than anything we see today in Western economies. If you were a member of the Communist Party, you were much, much better off than the average person in those countries. In fact, I think one of the takeaways from Singapore's experience, and to a lesser extent, I think Denmark and Sweden, is that market systems, they're not perfect. You don't get perfect income equality, but you get more equality than you do under traditional socialism.
The poor people in economically free countries do at least have access to food and basic needs. So I think the Poland and Estonia cases are so important, especially for those younger generations that you mentioned, right? I was born in the mid-80s, so I have some memories of traditional socialism and the fall of traditional socialism, and the movies and the television shows I watched growing up kind of reiterated that this is not a system that leads to human flourishing. This is a system that leads to human suffering. But people born in, you know, the year 2000 and later, they are far removed from lots of conversations and visible, tangible examples of traditional socialism and what it brings. And so I think that, you know, when I see students might, you know, push for kind of a socialist system, I try to remind them that traditional socialism really resulted in a lot of deaths, a lot of suffering, and that level of control over the economy, in order to enact that, it gives the government a lot of power to use force and authority to take resources and direct where they're going to go. These are big human costs to implement a system like that.
Yeah, indeed. And what's I think important to also emphasize is that some of the issues that younger people are particularly concerned about, such as, say, the environment, can learn a lesson from the experience of traditional socialist countries like Poland and Estonia under the USSR, where the environment was trashed. I mean, there was no incentive for the bureaucrats to worry about the environment because no one rewarded them for good environmental practices. So the kinds of things that young people seem to value are really exactly the kinds of things that were neglected or abused during that experience that you were talking about.
So I think that this project has done a really great job at really dispelling some of those common misconceptions about socialism, not just, you know, what it means, what it's looked like in practice. Really, hopefully, you know, these conversations are reaching a younger audience as well. So before we start to wrap up, I want to make sure that we touched on a lot of things, but I want to make sure that we are giving space and time to talk about anything else that you think is really important, really surprising, that we haven't really touched on at this point in the conversation.
Well, I think we really have hit most of the main points that have emerged through our 2-year research project. I think that what we should continue to emphasize is that, and this gets to your earlier statement. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's very true. There is no free lunch. Any economic benefit that you want is going to require some type of sacrifice. And I think realism, and that's why we called it the realities of socialism, realism demands that principle, that truism be recognized. What you're really hoping for, what you're aiming for in making voting decisions and what kind of society you want is where along that trade-off curve you want to be. And I think what we have established in that research program is that the benefits of a free market really are being lost in the debate about what kind of society we want to have. And the benefits go well beyond just a higher standard of living. They include things like longer lifespan, a healthier lifespan, a better and a cleaner environment. And this is a point I think that should be emphasized because environment is such an important priority of young people. A more democratic and capitalist society is going to be an environmentally preferable society. So I think I'd leave the viewers and readers of the volumes with the request that they enter this debate with an open mind, read the evidence, because I think the evidence is reasonably persuasive that when you abandon a market system, you're abandoning a better lifestyle, a higher standard of living, not just economically, but more broadly in terms of lifespan, environment, and personal freedom.
Absolutely. I don't think I could end on any better takeaway than that. Now, the listeners are aware that this podcast series is exploring the content of a series of books. So if y'all haven't read those actual publications, I highly recommend it. It's a wealth of data and historical context, and it's really just impossible to do justice to all of that in these brief conversations that I've had with the scholars involved. So I would recommend digging into those. And if you're interested, I'd recommend looking at the actual scholars who have contributed and continuing to read some of their other work, because all of those involved who have been exploring for the course of their career, what types of rules and institutions help us live a more flourishing, productive lives together. So, Steve, I just want to ask before we go, do you have any book recommendations beyond what has been published in this Realities of Socialism series that the interested listener can look to as their next steps in exploring more on this topic?
Well, I think the Essential Scholar series that you mentioned earlier, before we went on camera, the Fraser Institute has published a series called under the rubric of Essential Scholars that examines the contributions of giants like Adam Smith and Friedrich Hayek, and if I can put in a plug for my own little contribution, a monograph that I wrote with David Henderson on the UCLA School of Economics, which really is a more modern version of the Hayekian and Smithian principles, and Ricardo and Hume, and these classical scholars, the liberal classical liberal scholars, are really the foundation of understanding why a market system is so essential to creating what you just called a flourishing society. I would say that that's the place for the interested reader who isn't familiar with that literature to start.
I think that's an excellent recommendation, and I know of a podcast series that goes along with those books as well. Thank you so much, Steve, for sharing your time and your knowledge with me and with those who are listening. I hope listeners have found all of these conversations very informative, and that y'all are walking away from this series with a deeper understanding of the many faces of socialism, both traditional and what we see in places like Sweden, Denmark, and Singapore. Come back and listen to more of what we have to offer at the Fraser Institute. Visit our website and catch us on social media and wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome.
Thanks for joining us for the Realities of Socialism podcast, where we take a deep dive into the consequences of socialism as it was imposed on tens of millions of people during the 20th century. For more information, including infographics, free books, and more podcast episodes, visit realitiesofsocialism.org.